There is no absolute right to enter one's country, but at the same time, the government can't arbitrarily deprive you of that right.
COVID keeping residents away. It's Monday, April 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, assessing the level of hate against Asian Americans. Alleged police brutality on trial. Chefs cook to support Asian Americans. And holiday blooms. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A group of Australians not able to return home because of a strict COVID-19 quota on arrivals has filed legal action against the federal government. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The complaint has been lodged with the United Nations Human Rights Committee in Geneva over claims that Australians are being excluded from entering their own country. Authorities in Canberra closed international borders in March 2020 to curb the spread of the new coronavirus. Citizens and permanent residents are allowed back, but numbers returning are limited because of capacity constraints on airlines and in mandatory hotel quarantine. Since the pandemic began, almost 500,000 Australians have come home, but tens of thousands are still waiting to fly back. With community transmission of COVID-19 largely eliminated, the greatest risk to Australia is returning travellers who've brought the virus with them and have inadvertently infected hospital and hotel staff, according to health officials. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says it's a major concern.
The numbers from overseas in our hospitals is now 68 return travellers coming back. And like I said, that is a real risk for us.
A group of frustrated Australians has taken legal action because of what's described as the government's extreme restrictions. They say they're ordinary Aussies who've been left high and dry by an unfeeling government. In Canberra, officials have conceded that they couldn't predict when all stranded Australians would finally return home. They've said that quotas on those permitted to return were temporary and will be reviewed. Jane McAdam is the director of the Calder Centre for International Refugee Law, a research centre at the University of New South Wales.
Under international human rights law, there is no absolute right to enter one's country, but at the same time, the government can't arbitrarily deprive you of that right. So what that means is that people's entry may be subject to brief temporary restrictions, provided that they're reasonable, they're necessary, and they're based on clear legal criteria.
India has the largest number of Australian citizens and permanent residents who want to come home, followed by Britain, the United States, the Philippines, and Thailand. Australia has indicated that its international borders are unlikely to fully reopen until 2022. Australia has diagnosed just over 29,300 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began. The health department says 909 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You'll find much more on this story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. Also stop by our Facebook page and our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Taiwan minister accepts responsibility for train crash as questions mount. Flash floods and landslides kill at least 23 people in Indonesia. 17 missing in Indonesia fishing boat and cargo ship collision. Russia to build airport in Laos, train armed forces in sign of strengthening military ties. A year of unusually high U.S. activity noted in South China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can go to our website, that's voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Asians are a diverse group in the United States, but they all share a similar response to possible hate crimes. Activists spoke with VOA's Virginia Gunawan to give us a better perspective.
Violent acts against Asian Americans have been on the rise across the United States. In cities like New York and Philadelphia, there have been hate crimes against Asian Americans. A local community leader in Philadelphia describes an incident against two Indonesian teens on the subway.
They push the girls sitting on the bench and say, like, keep, move. And the girls from the other group just smack the Indonesian teen on the side of her head and, like, repeatedly. And then after that, the other one got punched and smacked until, like, her headphones fell off.
Philadelphia resident Simba Penyami Storms has long been active in anti-racism movements, from the Black Lives Matter movement of last summer to the Stop Asian Hate movement now.
There are just so many layers of hate in this country. I want us to peel them one by one and shed the light on them.
She says one thing that hampers investigation into possible hate crimes against Asian Americans is the reluctance to report incidents.
Typically, Asians are known to be that model minority. You know, in Indonesian, people probably will say, like, oh, you know what, like, just don't get involved. Because, you know, like, you maybe get hurt if you get involved. We don't speak up. We don't get the data. And we don't get the resources coming to our community. Resources like funding, resources like security, just coming for the police.
Attacks against Asians are reportedly on the rise across the U.S., driven by rhetoric and misinformation blaming China for the coronavirus pandemic. The advocacy group Stop AAPI Hate cites almost 3,800 incidents, ranging from racial slurs to physical attacks from March 2020 through February of this year. Data compiled by California State University's Center for the Study of Hate and Extremisms recorded 122 hate crimes in 2020, over twice the number in 2019. Activists say many factors could cause Asian Americans to underreport potential hate crimes.
They may not have had good interactions with the local police or the government in the past, and therefore do not trust that anything good's going to come out of it. And that's not an unfounded fear, right? Because of the stories about police misconduct too toward people of color in this country.
Indonesian Americans account for less than 1% of the estimated 22 million Americans of Asian descent. While most have been spared the recent spate of anti-Asian incidents, Indonesian consulates and the Indonesian embassy have issued an alert to be extra vigilant when out in the public. From Washington, D.C., Virginia Gunawan, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar security forces opened fire on pro-democracy protests, killing five people, according to a protester and media, as the military reinforced its bid to end dissent with arrest warrants for online critics and internet blogs. Protesters continue to come out every day to voice opposition. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is off to a nice start as you join us for VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by. The recent shooting deaths of eight people, including seven of Asian descent, at spas in the Atlanta, Georgia area have sparked a debate of what defines a hate crime. VOA Mandarin correspondent Adriana Zhang spoke with former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, Byung-jae Park, to find out more.
I think that there's been a lot of media coverage on kind of the increase in hate incidents towards Asian Americans. Being a first-generation American and growing up, I too have seen firsthand some of the hate incidents suffered by many folks in the Asian American community. You know, I wanted to point out that the hate incidents, you know, it's not a recent phenomenon. It actually has been here a very, very long time. It's just that the advent of social media and the pandemic with the coronavirus, in addition to the racially charged rhetoric of some of the folks in government, I think it has really brought to the forefront all these incidences of hate directed towards Asian Americans. So being a first generation American and having first observed these type of incidents certainly gives me a closer perspective of the real picture of what's going on and how that impacts, you know, communities of color, particularly when the hate is directed towards people with immutable traits, such as race, national origin, and things like that.
What is the real picture about the incident? Would you call it a hate crime? But some other people are saying that because the investigation is undergoing, so it's kind of too early to call it.
I want people to realize that only evidence that's been publicized so far as to the defendant's motivation was his own statement. Law enforcement was not going to just take that as at face value. I know a lot of people are running with that, but I know, just given my background and my experience in dealing with these type of investigation, that they're going to look for all evidence, what truly happened and why the person might have committed the crime. So I don't expect that they're going to just stop investigating just because the defendant claims that there were reasons other than race that motivated him to commit this crime. Matter of fact, if that's the case, I'll be utterly disappointed. And I believe that if the evidence shows after the thorough investigation is complete that it was motivated by race, I fully expect and would demand that the appropriate authorities bring charges under the relevant hate crime statute, whether it be federal or state.
What elements make a crime a hate crime?
The motivation of committing a certain act of violence has to be because of an actual trait like race or sex or national origin, or perceived trait like that. So that's what makes it a hate crime. And the reason the statute and charging of that statute is important in appropriate cases is the statute was designed not only to deter specific hate incidents against particular groups of folks, but secondly, having a statute on books like that gives a level of comfort to communities of color, people who are in protected classes, you know, gender, sexual orientation, LGBTQ. And so it's very important that the statute actually is used when appropriate and not just be a figurehead on the statute books.
Is it easy or difficult to prove it's a hate crime, and how would you go about it?
It's just an additional statute or an element under Georgia law. It's a recent hate crime statute that was passed in Georgia. It's not necessarily difficult if you have the evidence to do that. There is enhanced penalty provision under Georgia law if you could prove that the crime was committed based on motivated by race or ethnicity. In the federal statute under Section 245, it is a little bit more difficult in terms of the intent element, the threshold, evidentiary threshold to meet or get a conviction under the federal law. It's slightly higher because the word willfully is included in that statute. But it has happened before. It has been used before. And when I was U.S. Attorney, we always looked through the lens of trying to charge an incident like this, apply the hate crime statute. But sometimes the evidence may not be there to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and I understand if that's the case. But the investigation is ongoing. We'll have to just wait and see and not just accept the defendant's word for his motivations.
Join VOA Asia tomorrow at the same time as VOA Mandarin correspondent Adriana Zhang continues her conversation with Byung Jae Park, former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia: a Taiwan court released on bond the manager of a construction site whose truck authorities believe caused a train accident that killed at least 51 people. Family members mourn the dead at the crash site, Taiwan's worst rail accident in 7 decades. You'll find more at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, so does the trial of Derek Chauvin, the white former police officer accused of murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd, an African-American man. The first week of the trial featured graphic video and dramatic testimony of Floyd's arrest. Mike O'Sullivan reports Chauvin's supervisors questioned the former officer's actions, while his lawyer tried to plant the seeds of reasonable doubt.
Graphic images from police body cameras, security systems, and bystanders, all filling in the timeline on May 25, 2020, as police struggled to get Floyd into a patrol vehicle. Derek Chauvin later pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes. That was not standard practice, said a police official who was questioned by prosecutor Steve Schleicher.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill him.
Jurors also heard this week from bystanders, including an off-duty firefighter who had trained as an emergency medical technician. She struggled with emotion, saying she offered to help Floyd, but an officer refused to give her access.
I thought his face looked puffy and swollen, which would happen if you were putting a grown man's weight on someone's neck.
Chauvin's defense portrayed Floyd as a large man under the influence of drugs, creating an ongoing threat made worse by volatile bystanders. Police were responding to a report that Floyd had tried to buy cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill.
I saw the bill. I noticed that it had a blue pigment to it, kind of how a $100 bill will have, and I found that odd.
But as events unfolded, the clerk said he experienced disbelief and guilt over Floyd's treatment. A police emergency dispatcher who was watching a video feed became concerned and notified a sergeant.
Something might be wrong.
Retired Sergeant David Ploger said that after Floyd was handcuffed on the ground and had stopped resisting, Chauvin should have stopped applying pressure to his neck. Defense attorney Eric Nelson has said Floyd's death was caused not by the officer, but by drugs and a heart problem, and that Chauvin was struggling to restrain Floyd under conditions that became increasingly tense. Paramedics said Floyd had no pulse as he lay on the ground. He was later placed in an ambulance where attempts to resuscitate him were unsuccessful. The trial resumes on Monday. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, a young couple accidentally vandalized a painting worth about $500,000 at a gallery in Seoul, mistaking painting equipment used as part of a display nearby as for use on the artwork as participatory art. We encourage you to participate online with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after seeing the recent reports of elderly Asian Americans being attacked, a chef in Washington, D.C. decided to fight back using what he does best. Karina Bafrigian has the story.
Washington, D.C.-based chef Kevin Tiang believes everyone can and should fight against racism. For his part, Tiang decided to launch a charity takeout dinner series with other chefs to help protect the rights of Asian Americans.
And as soon as I called all the chefs and I said, hey, you know, there's been a rise in violence against the AAPI community. I want to know, are you able to help? And I didn't have to tell anybody anymore. Everyone said, yes, absolutely. It doesn't matter what it is. They're here for us and they support us.
The money raised helps fund a human rights group that advocates for Asian American rights in the U.S. 45 other chefs from dozens of Washington restaurants joined Tian's initiative.
So obviously it's important to me on a personal level because I am Asian American myself. I also have two younger daughters who, you know, I always think about when I hear stories of violence against AAPI community, especially towards women.
Every Sunday, the chefs that participate cook a special meal consisting of five courses. A dinner for two costs $150. On the first day, the chefs had about 80 orders.
Whether it's, you know, the black restaurants or AAPI, We love all these chefs, and so we want to do what we can to support them.
I have always been very active in the DC dining community, so when I saw that a lot of my favorite chefs, and more notably like Asian American chefs that were collaborating to support this cause, I definitely had to make the drive out here all the way from Virginia.
This study released at California State University in March showed that hate crimes against Asian Americans have spiked by 149%, even though hate crimes overall declined. And experts believe actual numbers might be higher than the official statistics.
I would not be surprised if the numbers reported by the Center on Hate and Extremism are an undercount, as you just suggested. Hate crime generally is underreported, and it's really hard to get accurate numbers in this context. Racial and ethnic minorities don't have excellent relationships with the police.
Tian believes silence only contributes to the problem.
This isn't anything new. I think you're starting to hear about it now because the crimes have become much more violent.
In the near future, Tian hopes to invite even more restaurants to participate in his charity project from all over the U.S. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
It remains Sunday here in the United States, and if you celebrate it, happy Easter. It's one of the busier holidays for local florists here, with families ordering spring blooms for their gatherings with loved ones. Isha Sarai speaks with a flower farmer and florist in Marshall, North Carolina, about their best-selling products this time of year.
Warmer weather, longer days, and blooming flowers all coincide with the Easter holiday. This year, despite the pandemic, is like any other as florists see an increase in business for the weekend.
People are just so excited that spring is finally here. It's been such a long winter. It's been longer than a normal winter. Like, it feels like last year was just winter the whole time. COVID has actually made people love flowers more, I think.
Easter, in which Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ, takes place either at the end of March or in early April, about the same time that tulips are in bloom in many places in the Northern Hemisphere.
People are really excited that the tulips are bursting out, and they're so, like more than any other flower, they're so vigorous, like the way they come up and they're huge right away and they grow so fast and then the blooms are so colorful and over the top. I guess that's the Easter connection, the whole idea of being reborn for a new season.
Copus, who farms all of the flowers that she sells, says that as beautiful as the job can be, it comes with many challenges.
I mean, it's super physical. We carry buckets of water and we, you know, stand all day and there's also a lot of, you know, repetitive tasks that require a certain amount of, like, muscle memory. Wrapping bouquets is a great example. It's one of those things that people find very frustrating because it looks easy, but it's hard.
Okay. Last year, in the height of the pandemic, Copus closed down her shop for months, only fulfilling deliveries. In that time, she started an online grocery delivery service out of the back of the store to support local farmers as the restaurant business declined.
We're interested in farming because the land is so beautiful and we love living here, and we wanted to find a way to use the resource in a productive way.
Now, after months of being shut down and undergoing a long winter, Copus is one of many florists excited to celebrate the Easter holiday and brighter days ahead. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Marshall, North Carolina.
That's our program. Thanks for listening to VOA Asia. We invite you to continue online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We also thank our VOA Asia team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.